You have the scriptures with you? If you do, what I'd like you to do is turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians 4 was the Bible study passage that we had last week in our own personal Bible study. So what I thought I'd do is just share some thoughts with you out of my own Bible study. I'm wondering, as we begin, if we could have maybe four people read. If one person would read verses 1 through 6, who would take that? And as many different translations as we have, great. Okay, let's... good. Verses 1 through 6. And then somebody take verses 7 through 12. Okay? Great. And then 13 through 15. Okay, Charles? And then 16 through 18. Okay, Ed? These are the four divisions that I made out of the chapter and constituted the four breaks. In many ways, 2 Corinthians is kind of a defense of the Apostle Paul's life and ministry. And as you know, in reading his life and ministry through the years, he had encountered a tremendous number of hardships and difficulties, the rejection of himself, the rejection of his message, the loss of friends, physical harm and danger that he encountered, and many, many other things. Well, these Corinthians are sitting back there in Corinth and are kind of looking at this, and they think to themselves, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, after all, we've watched this guy in action. As a matter of fact, we got scars all over our bods to show you what he does to us when he comes to town. And it's just his sins are catching up with him. Because their attitude toward Paul was that he was a hard-nosed, aggressive sort of a guy. He was about as gentle and tactful as a blunt axe. And when he came through town, he was like a water buffalo in a pansy bed. Not only that, they got a little uptight because they figured that Paul didn't keep his own word. As a matter of fact, he tells them here in 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians chapter 1, if you want to flip over to that, that he had in fact planned on coming to them. He says, and in this confidence, I was minded to come to you before that you might have a second benefit and to pass by you into Macedonia and to come again out of Macedonia on my way and to be brought on my way with you toward Judea. But he didn't do it. So he has to defend himself here. He has to explain why. And that explanation goes right on through the rest of the first chapter. And he picks it up again when he talks about the fact that he didn't know where Titus was when he was ministering in Troas. And so he explains the conditions surrounding his inability to be there simply because their view of Paul was that he was a man who didn't keep his word. When he made a promise, he didn't fulfill it. And not only that, Paul was always rebuking them for something. And you read his first letter, he begins by rebuking them. And, of course, his ending is a little bit more gracious than his beginning. But, boy, he really wails away at him all through the whole book. And so their attitude is, well, no wonder Paul has so many enemies. Good grief, anybody with that kind of an attitude and behavior pattern would have enemies. And so Paul sets down in this letter the answers to some of the questions and misgivings that have been generated in their own minds, trying to explain to them that this that has transpired has not been of his own doing, but really has been the providential hand of God. And that really, Romans 8:28 is true. All things do work together for good because he and his co-laborers love God and are called according to his purpose. Now, chapter 4 is an exciting chapter because he discusses the ministry here. And in the fourth chapter, really you have two ideas here. You have tribulation and triumph. And let me suggest that the key idea or the key thought here of the chapter is the phrase found in verse 1 and again in verse 16, we faint not. In this ministry, we faint not. Now, in verses 1 through 6, we faint not with a rejected message. The God of this world has blinded the minds of them that believe not. And that's the reason why the message is rejected. But we know that the ministry comes from God, therefore we faint not. And then in verses 7 through 12, we faint not with an earthen vessel. We faint not with the earthen vessel because we know that there's a treasure inside of it. And that contrast between the earthen vessel and the treasure makes God's glory shine. So we're perplexed, we're troubled, we're chased, we're smitten, we're cast down, we're constantly dying, but we don't faint. And the reason we're cast down, chased, smitten, and dying daily with Jesus is simply because we have an earthen vessel. Now in verses 13 through 15, he says, we faint not because of the promise of the resurrection. And he talks here about the fact that knowing that he which raised up the Lord Jesus shall raise up us also and shall present us with him. And boy, that's a great source of encouragement. So we're not going to faint. And then in verses 16 to 18, he says, we faint not with the continuing process of inner renewal. And this process that God is affecting in our lives is inwardly a renewing process. Outwardly, it's a decaying process. But the two go together. And because I got my eyes fixed on the renewal rather than the decay, I'm really encouraged, he says, and I'm not going to faint. So you see then that the first part of it, the first two sections, deal with the tribulation, a rejected message and an earthen vessel. The second two sections deal with the triumph, the promise of the resurrection, and the inner renewal that continues to go on a day-by-day basis. Now, unfortunately, our time does not allow us to really plumb in depth these four sections. But let me just kind of take a little of the cream off the top. And some of these are self-evident, and some of this will be new, and some maybe will whet your appetite to dig a little bit more. But in this first section, the rejected message, verses 1 through 6, I want you to notice that there are four people or groups of people mentioned. In verse 1, you have Paul. In verse 2, you have the accusers. In verses 3 and 4, you have the blinded people. And in verses 5 and 6, Jesus. Now, Paul says, as far as I'm concerned, I don't faint because this ministry has been given to me of God. And the two things that keep him going are, first of all, the ministry, this great task to which God has called him. And you get the idea when you read the Apostle Paul that he eats, he sleeps, he drinks, and he breathes this ministry. It's the consuming thing of his life. It's a passion. It's his lover. It's the thing that occupies his life and his motivating facilities night and day. He wakes up thinking about it. He goes to bed thinking about it. As he's making those tents, he's thinking about it. It's the ministry to which God has called him. And he says, with such a great task, how can anyone faint? And then the second thing that causes him not to faint is God's mercy. Now, this is mercy in distinction to grace. Grace is getting what you don't deserve. Mercy is not getting what you do deserve. And Paul says, I am the chief of sinners. But the mercy of God is able to cover that sin. And that mercy, which finds me at the point of my need with total and full acceptance of the presence of God, man, that's the reason I don't faint. And these are the things that keep Paul going. Now, in verse 2, you see the accuser. And it's interesting. They accuse the Apostle Paul of two things, of craftiness and of deceitfully handling the Word of God. Now, gang, craftiness has to do with personal dishonesty, deviousness, not being straightforward and truthful with people. Handling the Word of God has to do with manipulating the Word for personal gain. And let me suggest to you that the two go together. One who is not honest with himself will not be honest with the Word. One who is not honest with the Word will not be honest with himself. And if you want to handle the Word of God in integrity, you have got to begin by personal integrity and not skirt around the issues that the Spirit of God is dealing in your life on. This is what they accuse Paul with. And he says it's not true. He says, but by manifestation of the truth, I commend myself to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And that's such a fantastic idea. I want you to notice here that Paul does not commend himself to the logic of his argument. He does not commend himself to the rationale of the mind or his persuasive abilities. Rather, Paul says, I commend myself to the conscience. And the truth of what I've got to say resides in the response that takes place in your conscience. Great thought. In verses 3 and 4, you have the lost, the blinded. This is the third group of people mentioned here in these first 6 verses. And gang, one of the greatest burdens of the gospel is the rejection and hardness of heart that it reveals. And this has got to be one of the toughest aspects of the ministry. The fact that the gospel hardens hearts. Flip over with me to chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. He says, for we are unto God a sweet savor of Christ in them that are saved and in them that perish. To the one we are the savor of death unto death, to the other a savor of life unto life. And who is sufficient for these things? You know, we talk about our success stories. We come into the office excited. Let me tell you about this person that met Jesus. But you know, it's really tough to talk about the people whose hearts became increasingly calloused and hardened because of the message that we shared. But that happens also. Because of the blindness of men's hearts, they do not see the glorious light of Jesus Christ. And what we do when we share the message is we further add to the condemning process that's taking place in their lives. And boy, that is a tough pill to swallow. And no wonder there is a temptation to handle the Word of God deceitfully. No wonder there is a temptation to kind of be a little devious when it comes to some of the harder issues regarding the gospel. Do men really go to hell who don't know Jesus? And they look you right in the eye and ask you that. And you know that if you answer them the way the Bible answers it, there's a good chance you'll turn them off. And not only that, it'll add to the hardening process. And I say that's hard. And that's particularly hard when you're talking to people who are members of your own family or your own loved ones. When year after year after year, you just butt your head against a brick wall that in all outward appearances seems to be getting higher and thicker by the day. It's tough. But Paul says, with the blinded, I faint not. And then, in verses 5 and 6, we have Jesus. Now, it's interesting. Jesus here in chapter 4 is contrasted with Moses in chapter 3. Now, let's notice here the progression of thought. Flipping back to chapter 3, in verse 7, notice what happens here. It says that the face of Moses was veiled because he had a fading glory. And then it says in verse 15 of chapter 3 that the hearts of the people are veiled. And then in chapter 4 and verse 3, he tells us that the gospel is veiled. From the face of Moses to the hearts of the people, to the gospel itself. There's the progression. And notice in chapter 2, in verse 15, you see that the people are perishing. And then in chapter 3, in verse 14, you see that their hearts are continually, and this is a process, are constantly being turned to stone. And then in chapter 4, in verse 4, you see that they're blinded. Now notice a little more clearly, therefore, the contrast between Moses and Jesus Christ. Now let's just jot these down on the board. Let's put Moses on one side and Christ on the other. Okay? Now notice that the glory of Moses is a reflected glory. His is a reflected glory, where for Christ it's an embodied glory. That's the reason Moses had to have the veil on his face, so that the children of Israel could not see that his was a fading glory. Because it came from the outside rather than from within, it went away. But Jesus' glory came from the inside, and that's why we see here in chapter 4 that we have the open face of Jesus Christ in verse 6. The glory of the face of Jesus, because his is an embodied glory. Now, under Moses, we have a divine law. That's what made his face shine. He was up there in Sinai, got the law, came down with it. A divine law. But with Jesus Christ, it was what? A divine grace. Now, with Moses, the law brought about judgment. Judgment on sin. But grace that came through Jesus Christ brings mercy. This is the reason why Paul says he doesn't faint. Under Moses, therefore, this judgment ends in death, and with Jesus it ends in life. The life of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And therefore we see that the glory of Moses is a fading glory. With Jesus, it is an eternal glory. An everlasting glory. And there's the contrast between Moses and Christ. A glory that lasts forever. Well, let's see. How much further shall we go on this? Well, let's just a couple of thoughts out of verses 7 through 12, okay? You still with me? Notice the gradation in verses 8 through 12. In verse 8, he says, "We are troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We are persecuted or perplexed, but not in despair." Or as another translation says in verse 8, we're hard-pressed. Things are going against us. And then in verse 9, he says, persecuted, but not destroyed. Or as another translation puts it, we're at a loss as where to flee. We don't know where to go. And then it tells us that he is cast down, but not destroyed. He's chased, and he's caught, and he's thrown down. And then it tells us in verses 10 following that after he's thrown down, he's constantly put to death. And all of this takes place because he's in an earthen vessel. Now, the idea of the earthen vessel here is a clay pot, which was the cheapest container they could find back in those days. It would be like having written across your chest here, no refund and without deposit. After use, throw it away. We don't want it back. That's the idea of the earthen vessel here in verse 7. But we say, well, we don't despise this clay pot. You know, we're going through it, it's tough, but we don't despise it because inside of us dwells a treasure, the treasure of Jesus. And the fact of the matter is, the more clay the pot, the richer the treasure appears because of the contrast. The frailer, the weaker the vessel that I have, the more glorious the treasure contained in it appears. And that's the reason, he says, we faint not. Now, let me just skip through the next section. It's really terrific, but we're just out of time. And let's go to verses 16 to 18. And I want you to notice here that we have a ratio of inverse proportions mentioned in verse 16. He says, "We faint not because our outward man perishes, yet the inward man is renewed day by day." Now, let's chart that. Do we have a... Maybe I can just write this on a graph here. If we were to plot this on a graph, it would look something like this, I think. And we'll put our age down here, huh? 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, depending on how long you plan on living. And up here, You have spiritual renewal. That's the inward man being rejuvenated. And down here you have physical decay. And we'll say that the division between spiritual renewal and physical decay is right there. Okay, now what he's saying is that the older you get, the greater the decaying process. But the older you get, the greater the renewal process. So the two things are taking place simultaneously. The older I get, the clay pot gets chipped, it gets cracked, it gets broken, has to be mended, pieces of it have to be put together again. Some of the chips never fit quite right, and you have to throw them away. And that's the process, until finally someday they say, the old clay pot, she ain't what it used to be, let's bury the thing. But, he says, that inner renewal, man, that just gets gooder and gooder. Boy, life just gets better and better and better, because more and more, as he talks about in chapter 3, verse 18, the last verse of chapter 3, he says, he's getting more like Jesus. So that I am being transformed inwardly as I am decaying outwardly. That's what happens. And so what I want you to do now is notice the contrasts in verses 15 or 16 through 18. Let me start you off on them, and then I'll let you add to them. For example, you see the seen and the unseen. There is one set of opposites. You have the moment and the eternal. There's another set of opposites. You have weight and lightness in the King James. That's another set of opposites. Now, as you're reading along, why don't you fire them off to me? What are some other opposites? The inner man and the outer man. Affliction and glory. Perish and renewal. Transient or temporal and eternal. Excellent. Seen and unseen. Great. Okay, now as you look at those, you'll notice that the first set has to do with there. The second set has to do with this. And they're in contrast to each other. As a matter of fact, we find out a couple of lessons out of this, says the Apostle Paul. First of all, this process is so great that in comparison with this process, it's insignificant. I got pain in my body. And I walk around with that pain in my body for 40 years, and it bothers me. But what would happen if you had to have that pain for eternity? Wouldn't that be horrible? What have I got to look forward to in eternity? A painless glory. Therefore, the 40 years of affliction seems as nothing to me because of what I got ahead of me. And just every contrast is exactly the same. And so the light affliction is but for a moment, and it works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. And that's the second lesson. God allows this to take place because it enhances that. He allows the afflictions to take place, these light afflictions in the body, because it helps bring about the eternal glory. It aids in the process. A spirit of dependence. Getting your eyes focused on the right things. As you see that pot crack, you begin to realize, well, now let's see, life isn't wrapped up in the ability to keep the old pot. You know, the five B's that take over every life, bald, bifocal, bridges, bulges, and bunions. We all get them. It's not a question of if, it's simply a question of when, huh? And this, as soon as one comes, we think to ourselves, surely there must be something more in life than this. And God uses it to fasten our eyes on the eternal. And that's what he's talking about here. And notice, gang, that it's not the eternal with the temporal. It is the eternal in contrast to the temporal. And the Bible teaches us clearly that irrespective of our vocation, irrespective of our calling, God says, do not fasten your eyes on the temporal. Fasten your eyes rather on the eternal. Because temporal goals will not last. They're like the pot you're living in. It's going to crack and break. Eternal goals. Now, we're not talking about what you're doing. We're talking about how you view what you're doing. And two people can be doing exactly the same job, and one be living for the eternal and the other living for the temporal. It has to do with a man's attitude. It has to do with a person's heart, his lifestyle, the goals, the things that motivate him, the things that are really important to him or to her, as the case may be. And so Paul's lesson to us, and gang, I don't know how you are, but I tell you, in the personnel department, our theme song is Mickey Mouse. M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E. We sing that every morning. Isn't that right, Jan? And I tell you, I get tired of it. I get tired of pushing papers from this side of the desk to that side of the desk. I'd rather, much rather be out there in the ministry. And I think to myself, God, they're going to burn these papers. Every one of them, they're going to be burned. And people are going to read them and going to throw them away. My neighbor, where I live, worked for a number of years in the Pentagon. He's a sharp, young naval officer. And he said that his job was a briefing officer. And as he would make these reports, then he'd present them. And then after he presented, they'd go through the shredding machine and down to one of the sub-basements, the last basement in the Pentagon. And down there, there was a paper recycling plant. And all the shredded paper would go into the recycling plant. They would make the paper over and come back through again. And he said that as he was sitting there writing out the reports, he had the disquieted feeling that all he was doing was feeding that recycling machine downstairs. Well, I don't know about you, gang, but I identify with that. But you see, it's not what we do that's important. It's how we view what we're doing. Because what we're doing is by the will of God to the glory of God. And we don't look at things that are seen, but things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are temporal, and with our clay pots will someday die. But the things that are unseen, they're eternal. And they're the things that we fasten our objectives, our hopes, our aspirations. These are the things that we live for. Amen? Well, I wish we had more time on that. Frankly, I'd rather share the word than the report with you, and that's why I've taken so much time doing that. Let's go to the report, okay? Well, gang, I spent 3 weeks in 4 countries, Mexico, Costa Rica, Brazil, and Argentina. Had a great time. It's more fun than the law allows. It was just super. I had the privilege of traveling with a friend of mine, a businessman from Amarillo, Texas, by the name of George Morris, a highly successful individual in the business world. He told me in confidence on the trip that... no, I better not tell you then, should I? But he does very well. He's one of the outstanding insurance salesmen in the world. He sells between $12 and $15 million worth of insurance every year. So this is life insurance that he sells. And we had a great, great time together. He's a very aggressive American. And that was really fun. And the guys down there really received him well. And I think he made a significant contribution to the trip. In Mexico, I had some time with Carlos Recoy. And Carlos, of course, is a Mexican who spent some time in the United States when his father was with the Organization of American States and here in Washington, D.C., and now living down there as an area representative. And we were talking about the ministry, and there were a couple of things he mentioned that I thought you'd be interested in. First of all, he pointed out that Mexico was kind of two countries. Mexico City was kind of a country within a country. For Mexico City, the people had a tendency to be cosmopolitan, whereas in the other cities, they tended to be provincial. in Guadalajara and Monterrey and these other cities where they had operated, the people in their vision didn't see beyond the city limits. But in Mexico City, they had kind of a global perspective and a global view. And so because of this, as they're thinking about their strategy, they're moving more and more in the direction of majoring on Mexico City itself. And then another thing that came out in our conversation was that because many of the university students come from what we would call the fledgling middle class, this would be the lower end of the spectrum, where mom and dad and all the kinfolk get together and help junior go to the university, and it's kind of a pooled resource deal in hopes that junior's education will be such that he can come back to the community and then we get having a better job, lift everybody together up into a higher economic system. And so that there's a tremendous pressure on the part of the university student after he graduates to return home to fulfill his family obligations. And this, of course, mitigates against, as you can well imagine, availability for further training and development and the Navigator goals and objectives. Because of this, we're beginning to think in terms, possibly, that what we want to do is to minister at the private universities rather than the secular universities. Excuse me. Because though they're smaller, they come from the upper spectrum of the middle class and upper classes, and therefore are more financially solvent and consequently more available for training and development. So we had a lot of interaction on this. And let me add that the ministry there is going super good, just really well. Has some real sharp guys that are tied in there, some young potential contact points that will be going out in a few years. Then we drove over to Puebla, where Dick Miller is. Now, Dick just kind of barely arrived on the scenes. He hasn't got the language down well. As a matter of fact, I could even detect an accent. And I don't know Spanish, so if I could detect an accent, I knew he had an accent. But the Mexicans love him. Absolutely love this guy. They set an extra place at the table at night because they always know there's somebody's going to come in unexpected. And literally, the non-Christians beat a path to his door. He virtually doesn't have to go out of his house to minister. And God has done something in preparing the hearts of those people there. Well, one night when we were there eating, a couple of guys came in and sat down and ate, non-Christian fellows, and just friends of Dick's. And then after dinner, Dick will share the gospel with them. And 2 or 3 in the morning, they'll just sit around talking about the gospel. And boy, things are breaking wide open there. And he's more excited than a blind dog in a meat house. Just having an absolutely terrific time. So everything there is greatly encouraging. And Dan Travis, who is now the national director, has got things under control. The men look to him. He's obviously God's choice as the national director there. And the whole Mexican situation, I think, is very healthy. Went down to Costa Rica, spent a couple of days there with Jorge Davila and Zaida, his wife. And some of you may have met them when they were here in the United States. They were here for about 3-5 months. I can't remember exactly how long. Lived with Mert and Madeline Martin in Norfolk before Mert went down to Mexico. Great couple. Jorge's a real man's man. And just a very attractive young guy. And he was telling me that there are basically 3 groups of people that it's possible to work with. First of all, there are the Protestants. These are the evangelicals coming from the fundamentalist churches. Now, the problem in majoring with this group of people is that the churches have been established by bringing in North American and European forms and systems so that they sing the same choruses, the same songs, the same kind of a Sunday school, the same form of worship. It's really a little piece of America with a Spanish accent. And because of that, it's not really truly Brazilian or truly Costa Rican or truly Mexican or whatever country they're working in. And so, although that's a possible place to work, it does have that disadvantage to it. Then another group is what we would call the evangelicals. And these are Costa Ricans who are interested in Christianity but have absolutely no respect at all to what denomination or background they're from. Roman Catholics, Lutherans, Episcopalians, Methodists. It doesn't matter what. Just what did I say?
Evangelical.
Ecumenical. Thank you. That's exactly what I meant, Bob. And then the third group is the secular group. These are the radical, free-thinking university students, strong leaders in their own right, very, very secular in their thinking. And Jorge, up to this time, has been majoring pretty much in the second group, the ecumenical group, and feels now that probably what he wants to do is to begin working in the secular group, the third group. So this is a time of transition for him. And as I just go through here, I'd like to share some prayer requests with you. And that would be one prayer request, that you pray for Jorge Davila as he establishes himself in the ministry. Now, Jorge is one of these guys that has never attended the university. As a matter of fact, he's just starting his university work right now. He's about 26 years old and married, has a child, and it's just beginning. But he's the kind of guy who you would never suspect that he didn't go to the university. You know, when you meet Jorge and you say, oh, man, I'm surprised. You mean you didn't go to the university? It's just like me. When people meet me, they say, oh, man, I'm sorry. You mean you did go to the university? So, you know, people are different there. But he is really challenged and turned on regarding the Costa Rican ministry, particularly as it represents the key to Central America. And as we were talking about the strategy and what we wanted to do on a global basis, he said to me, well, Walt, what do the navigators want me to do here in Costa Rica? What part do you want me to play? And I said, well, Jorge, that's precisely why I'm here. We're asking you that question. You've got to tell us what part you're to play. And I could see that that really was significant to him, that these national strategies, by the way, that we decided on at the CPC conference are a real morale booster and a tremendous influence, I think, around the world, because it's involving the nationals in the planning process. It's asking them how they feel about it. After all, it is their country, and they ought to know better than anybody else what the needs are. And so I think it's a very wholesome thing. Moving quickly into Brazil, I spent my most time there simply because it's the most developed work. We've been there 10 years. We have a national director in Aldo Berndt. We've got a fine staff and a very healthy and prospering ministry. In every respect, things are really going well. My wife asked me when I returned home, what was the highlight of the trip? And I told her that beyond a doubt, the highlight of the trip was Aldo Berndt. He is a great brother. And from my set of eyeballs, beyond a doubt, a brilliant choice on the part of Jim Peterson to head the Brazilian work. He is broad in his thinking. He is very perceptive. He's just a good man all the way around. And right now, he's in the process of really getting used to hanging onto the reins, because Jim, as you know, just not too long ago moved up here to the United States, and that was at the time when Aldo was appointed as the national director. And they've got some things that they're working on that I'd like to share with you in the form of prayer requests, three or four things. First of all, is the need for depth in the Scriptures. Now, gang, like the United States, Brazil, in all of Latin America, as far as that's concerned, has been steeped in existentialism. Now, as you know, existentialism simply teaches that there is no meaning or purpose to life. Consequently, there is no future, just like there was no past. That's why we're called the now generation, because now is all we've got. And because you live for the now, you've got to get the best out of what you've got, and therefore you look for an experience. And this is why the rise of the of sex and immorality, of the dope culture, and all of the rest. Now, it's out of this environment that these people come, this existential environment, which teaches that meaning is to be found in the experience level. And so they bring this into the scriptures, and so everything is experience-oriented, which is good. It has to do with application. And that's a very healthy thing, particularly for a babe in Christ. Don't tell me, you know, to go deep in the scripture. Don't start preaching doctrine to me. What does it say to me? What does Jesus want me to do about it? That's what they are. And everything is application-oriented, because application is experience. And that's very healthy up to a point. But what they need to add to that, it's not an either or, it's a both and. What they need to add to that is to go deep in the scriptures, because you cannot ask yourself, what does it say to me, until you have answered first, what does it say? Application has to follow correct understanding, proper interpretation. Otherwise, you can end up misapplying the scriptures. Now, I'm not overly alarmed in this area. I don't think that we've got heresy on our hands or anything like that. But I know that this is one of the great needs among our guys there, this fledgling national work, and something that I really would ask you to pray with us about, that God would bring them deep into the scriptures. Then another prayer request has to do with the graduates of the university ministry. Now, because Jim has ministered with these secular people, they have, in coming into Christianity, not particularly desired to align themselves with evangelical Christianity, because as we've talked before, it tends to be a caricature of that which is truly Brazilian. It tends to be an imposing of a foreign culture upon them. The songs that they sing, the form of worship, the way they do things isn't, in the final analysis, Brazilian, rather it is American. And they want something that is uniquely Brazilian. They want to do it their way. And so it's kind of like a square peg in a round hole when they enter into these worship services, and they don't really know exactly how to handle that. And that would be an area where, just for wisdom as to what God would have them do and how to go about that. And then a third prayer request is for finances. The developing of a strong financial base among the Brazilian people. The Brazilian people are very, very generous. But they're generous in different areas than we are in the United States. The Brazilian people are very people-oriented rather than production-oriented. If you and I were supposed to meet somebody downtown at 12 o'clock, at a quarter after 12, we'd be saying, well, let's see, I'll give them 5 more minutes, and then I hear, I guess they're not coming. Something must have happened. 20 minutes, that's ample time. There, they show up for a meeting with somebody, supposed to meet them at 12 o'clock. It's 12:30, and they haven't shown, and they look at their watch and say, let's see, 12:30, huh? Well, I'll wait another hour and a half. And maybe 1 or 1:30, they'll show up. As a matter of fact, you make an appointment at 12 o'clock, and you show up at 12:30 knowing that the other guy won't show up until 1, and you'll be a half hour early anyway. So they're not production-oriented. They don't think in terms of the clock. They think in terms of people. For example, you go to a Brazilian's home for dinner. Dinner's at 6 o'clock, so you show up at 7. And at 7 o'clock, you sit down, and you sit in the living room, and they pass out something to drink. And you sit there and drink for a while and talk for about an hour, hour and a half, so now it's about 8:30, 9 o'clock. And finally, the wife stands up and says, well, I'll go get dinner ready. And she goes into the kitchen, and from scratch, she begins to prepare her dinner. And you sit down and fellowship a little bit longer, and maybe 10 or 10:30, you sit down to eat. Now, this is a 6 o'clock meal, say, that you've been invited to. And that's the way they are. They're not interested in how much time it takes. They're not interested in the production. They're interested in the relationships. And they're a very generous people with their time. They're a very generous people with their home, with the things that they have. But the idea of giving financially to somebody who is in quote unquote full-time work is a brand new concept to them. They're just not used to thinking that way. Tithing is a totally foreign concept to them. Tithe, what's that word mean? Who knows? There may not even be a Portuguese word that's equivalent to it. I don't know. But this is where the orientation has to come in, to help the people to learn to think in terms of being generous, not only with their lives and generous with their time and their homes, but also with their financial resources. And it's an education process, and it's something that Ken Lotus and Aldo Berndt and some of the other staff down there are working on, and something that I would commit to you for prayer. By the way, they've got an interesting view. If I can just take a half a second here, half a minute, and give you an interesting view on the law. I kind of like their view on the law. The law is not to be obeyed. The law is to be taken under advisement. Because laws don't understand the situation. I'm driving in my automobile, and I come up to a sign that says, stop. Now, am I, an intelligent human being, going to obey an inanimate piece of metal? That's absolutely ridiculous for me to submit myself to a piece of metal. It's obvious that when that sign says stop, it doesn't mean literally bring your car to a complete stop. What it means is we want to take you into advisement that it'd be a good idea to be careful as you come to this corner. And that's how they view the law. That signal that changes indiscriminately from red to green and back to red again, it doesn't know the situation, it doesn't know the traffic pattern, it doesn't know there's a car coming, and it's absolutely ridiculous to park your car there at a red light when there's no traffic coming in the other direction. That's the dumbest thing you can do. Now, that's their view of the law. Pretty neat, huh? I thought to myself, I'd make a good Latin. Oh, the other side of the coin is, by the way, that there are more fatalities in the city of Curitiba than any other city in the world. That there is the other side to that. Argentina. Spent just a day and a half in Argentina. The work is just getting started there. I can't even think of the names right now. John Carroll's and the Larry Blakes did the language study in Buenos Aires. 24% of Argentina lives in Buenos Aires. And then they moved to a little community about 35 or 40 miles to the south called La Plata. It's a small town with a large university. And they're just getting settled. When I was there, the furniture was just still being ordered, and they were still trying to find their way from one house to the next and around the block, what direction was north, and so forth. As a matter of fact, Fernando Gonzalez, he also is there with him, speaks Spanish since he's a Colombian citizen, is a product of the Brazilian work. He came and picked us up at the airport, and we had to stop two or three times on the way back to La Plata again to try to figure out what direction La Plata was. So it's brand new to them. They don't know where they are any more than I know where I was. I was as much help in trying to get his home as he was. And that was no help at all. But the gang have got a tremendous attitude and a gung-ho spirit. And Fernando says that the Blakes and the Carrolls are doing very, very well in language study, coming along beautifully on it. And that's a great encouragement. Something to pray for regarding them is the health situation. Larry was in to see the doctor twice in the day and a half I was there, getting blood tests and other things. The doctor diagnosed it as just total physical fatigue. He's been pushing it so hard and trying to get on top of things, he's just out of gas. And the doctor just suggested he throttle back a little bit. You might want to pray for his wife, Joan. She's right on top emotionally, but it's a tough situation. She's pregnant. She has a little boy, Chris. How old is Chris? About 2 years old, más o menos. They live in about the 10th floor of a small apartment in downtown. Now, what do you do with a two-year-old boy in the middle of your pregnancy on the 10th floor of a small apartment in downtown? That's tough. And especially when you don't know your way around town, you haven't really mastered the language yet, you're still in the process of learning it, and you're in a foreign culture. So pray for her. Not that there's anything critical, but it's just some real needs, I think, there. Ida, the wife of Fernando, has a slipped kidney. And so what they're going to have to do is open her up, operate on her, and try to push her kidney back up in place and sew it there. I don't know what all that's going to involve, but they're a little concerned about that too. So just little physical things have plagued them since they have been there, first one, then another, and I know that they would really appreciate your bearing down in prayer for that. Well, take a couple of moments just to entertain some questions. Oh, I was telling them about the machine guns. We drove from La Plata to Buenos Aires, spent a little time in there before catching the plane on home. So as we were driving on the outskirts of Buenos Aires, this policeman motions to us and pulls us over. And about four of the policemen kind of surround the car with their hands on their revolvers. And this guy comes and asks Larry to get out of the car. And Larry gets out. And he's looking through his papers. And I look across the street. I'm sitting in the front seat. And I look across the street, catty corner. And out from behind this telephone pole is this other guy with a Thompson submachine gun leveled right at us, looking at us. And I looked at him and that machine gun, and that machine gun was looking right at me. You know, it made me a little nervous. And I thought to myself, you know, I wonder if that guy knows whether that thing's on safety or not. You know, I wonder if he realizes I'm a friend and not an enemy. You know, you just kind of sit there and you wonder. But fortunately, it didn't go off, and everything was okay. But it's an armed camp. You walk into the bank, and they have a bulletproof box that covers both doors, and a guy's in there with a sawed-off shotgun and a submachine gun. Because the revolutionaries, you know, would come in and rob the banks, and the police could not control them. The government couldn't control them. So finally, the government said, listen, you have to control them yourself. So they built the box and put the guy in it, and no more bank robberies. But everywhere you go, there are just lots of guns, and all of them, you know, you don't see the guns hanging over the shoulders. You see them down pointing at people. And it, like I say, it makes you a little nervous as you walk the streets. But those are the guns. Any other questions on it? Larry would like to, his approach is to become friends with university students, again, working with a secular group of students rather than through the churches and the religious groups. And they have already made contact and established friendships with a number of students there in town. Of course, the city's crawling with students, you know, and every park is full of them, either making love to their girlfriends or just sitting around playing the guitar or doing something else. There's no place else to go. So to walk through the park or walk downtown and establish friendships is very, very easy to do. And the Latin being a very friendly sort of an individual, that part of it's quite encouraging. Yeah, the question is, what is the atmosphere? Is it friendly or is it hostile because they're foreigners? That varies from city to city. In La Plata, because it is not a hotbed of revolutionary activity, the students tend to be a little more conservative, a little more conventional, and consequently they're finding a great deal more acceptance there than they did, for example, in Buenos Aires. Okay? Bob, thank you.